Well, as Esther was saying there, Ecclesiastes 3, and in particular verses 1 through 8 that we'll spend most of our time on, if not all of it this evening, is beautiful poetry. It has inspired songs and other poetry, and it teaches us about life, as the whole of Ecclesiastes does, and how to live life not under the sun, that is, with God edited out of the picture, with anybody and any being above the sun edited out. Don't live life under the sun, but live life under the one who made the sun. And as we seek to do so, and as we seek to make decisions and make choices in life, as we seek to approach crossroads that we may find ourselves at, and divergences in the road from what we thought to what might otherwise be, we confront in our own experience just exactly what Ecclesiastes 3, 1 to 8 is all about. Some of us would like life to be just the same all the time. We'd like it to be dead routine so that we'll know 18 weeks next Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock exactly what we'll be doing, because it's what we'll be doing next Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Some of us, of course, would find a life like that stifling and fearful. The one thing that we can be absolutely certain of is that as Christians and grown-up Christians, as those who seek to live to please God, as those who wrestle over the guidance issues and what should I do, what's the right thing to do in this situation, as we approach those decisions which are not matters of sin or not sin, they're not holiness decisions, and they're not just matters of taste, we think there's something more going on than that. As we approach those decisions in life that are matters of wisdom, those choices that reflect biblical wisdom, we are doing so in a world and in our own lives that are full of change, ceaseless change. The one thing that we can be absolutely sure of is change. We are all undergoing changes physically. It is, for some of us, growing up. For some of us, it is growing back down again, aging. That physical change affects our abilities, it affects our appearance, it affects the way we are perceived in society, and certainly the way that we perceive ourselves. We are all subject to huge emotional changes. We can go from high to low very quickly, sometimes from low to high quite quickly as well. Our moods can swing, our frame of mind can change at a moment's notice. One bad curry and we are emotionally distraught and probably physically distraught for some time to come. Occasions affect us, our environment affects us. A lovely sunny morning like today's just brings out smiles all over our faces. And of course, we face many changes in our circumstances and in our activities. As some of us here are facing major changes in our jobs, major changes in our friendships, in where we live. As a fellowship, we are facing major change in our denominational association. And these changes are absolutely inevitable. And in the midst of them, and Koheleth the preacher, almost certainly Solomon, who wrote Ecclesiastes, doesn't just talk about life changing in some sort of easy way. What Koheleth goes right to the heart of is the fact that life is full of contradictions, inevitable contradictions. So, let me just pursue a skiing analogy, since I know that all of us ski all the time, and Koheleth was obviously fond of skiing, or not. Some of us have an idea that when we are grown up and when we are mature and when we've got life sorted, because that's what grown-up mature Christians have, it's life sorted, then our lives are like the sort of the downhill skiing event. Our lives are just one long set of graceful, sweeping curves, fantastically managed. See them coming a mile off. You take the right line. The weight is distributed perfectly. You anticipate everything.
and you don't fall over, and you do it just perfectly. It is graceful, thrilling, exhilarating. There are no upsets. When you're a mature Christian, when you're grown up, life is like that downhill event that we've seen, I guess most of us on our TV screens, and some of us done it for real, just looks absolutely incredible. Swooping, fast, controlled progress. Never a ski wrong. But Koheleth says, no, life's not like that. Don't expect it to be like that. If you think it's going to be like that, you will be constantly upset with life. Life is like the other downhill skiing event that, or one of the others, life is like the slalom. It doesn't look that elegant compared to the downhill racing thing. You know, the skiers, boom, 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 all over the place. Short, jerky movements. Well, they look a bit that way. I know that they're smooth as silk for those who are doing them when they're done well. And it's just one way, then the next way, and then the next way. And the progress is slower. It is incredibly careful. In some respects, it requires more skill, a different kind of skill. It isn't racy. Seems a lot easier to fall over. But it's a slalom. What Koheleth does is he tells us that life is full of change and that the changes are contradictory. There's a path through life, and first of all it twists to the left and then it will twist to the right again, winding first one way and then another. So there is a time to heal and there is a time to kill, or verse 3, the other way around. Now that seems odd, doesn't it? Because we like to think ourselves as being, you know, one thing. I'm a healer. I don't kill. Ask a shepherd. A shepherd knows that there's a time to heal and a time to kill. A vet knows there's a time to heal and a time to kill. There's a time to tear down and a time to build. Well, that's true. Ask a developer. You know, we were thinking about different kinds of wisdom last week and how they relate to the kind of work that we do and the kind of things we naturally enjoy doing. Ask a property developer. Ask a builder. And he'll tell you, yes, there's a time to tear down and a time to build. There's a time to embrace. And you think, oh, I'm an embracer. Good. But there's also a time to refrain. Verse 5. There's a time for war. And there is also a time for peace. You say, well, you can't be contradictory like that. Well, G.K. Chesterton once said that consistency is the virtue of small minds. In actual fact, life is contradictory. Ask a patriot. And a patriot will tell you that there is a time for war and a time for peace. Ask a general, and he'll tell you the same thing. So life is contradictory. What are we going to make of it? There's no difference in this between a Christian and a non-Christian in one sense. There's no difference in the circumstances of life being contradictory and changing between a Christian and a non-Christian. What are we going to make of it as those who are grown-up Christians? What are we going to make of it as those who live under the one who made the sun? How are we going to cope with the contradictory stuff that life seems to fling at us, that comes, you know, poof, out the blue and unannounced? What are we going to make of it as Christians? How are we going to negotiate the slalom that is life? Well, of course, Koheleth wants us to take God into account. And he wants us to live our lives in the fear of God, which is the beginning of wisdom. And so as he takes us in this beautiful poem through the changing seasons of life, he has, if you like, one point to make. And this is in one sense what the whole point of having this passage in a series on the wisdom decisions that grown-up Christians want to make before God. There's one point to this evening's passage. There's one reason why it's in here.
And this one reason and this one passage and New Testament counterparts are in one sense, I think, right at the very core of what it means to be a wise Christian, what it means to make decisions as grown-up Christians that are wise before God. So what's the point of the passage? Well, it describes a life that is contradictory. It describes a progress through life that is like the slalom skier, left, right, right, again, left, right, left, and all the rest of it. But it's very easy in the beauty of the poetry and in the things that it's a time to do to miss the point of the poem and miss the point of what Ecclesiastes is teaching us. It's very easy for us to concentrate on the born dying thing, for instance, or planting and uprooting. We think of the activity. If we do that, then this passage just seems to be an almost random selection of stuff that life delivers on our doorstep. It's very easy to miss the point, and it's easy to miss the point because when we're reading and we read a piece of poetry like this, our minds tend to fasten on to the things that change through a poem. Our attention is grabbed by the changes and the things that change. But in actual fact, the poem is written to make a point differently. And the point is obvious when we ask the question, what's the key word? So what's the key word in Ecclesiastes 3, 1 to 8? It's not difficult. What is the repeated word? What is the rhythmic word? What is the word that sets the rhyme and the rhythm to the whole thing? What is the word that is the architectural word that gives the whole poem its strength and stands the poem before us in this unmissable way? What is it? Well, it is the word, have a guess. Very good. 29 times in 8 verses. That's got to be a record for repetition in the whole of the scriptures. 29 times in 8 verses. You're counting them now, aren't you? If you come across 30, let me know. So if we're going to understand what being a grown-up Christian who is wise before God is all about, if we're going to let Ecclesiastes speak to us here, if we're going to let one of the most beautiful and profoundly challenging to our modern algorithmic, logical, process-managed world, if we're going to let it place the challenge before us, if we're going to let it teach to us the art of discipleship, then we have to understand what this repeated, key, architectural, rhythmic word is all about. So what does it say? What is the time? Oh, what's the time, Mr. Wolf? There are, broadly speaking, two ways in which the Bible writes about time, and we need to make sure that we've got the right one in our minds here. The words are important. A chap that was running United Beach Missions that I used to go on when I was young, Gerard Crispin, was running them in France, and Gerard's French was not good, and yet he felt that God was calling him to start beach missions in France, and so he learned French. Just by the way, on that, don't expect that God's going to call you to do something that you think you can do. He might call you to do something that you need to learn new skills for. Well, anyway, Gerard had to come home early from one of the beach mission camps in Ulgat, and he rushed to the railway station in Ulgat and started asking for, well, he thought he was asking for a timetable. But he was using the wrong word in French. And instead of asking for the horaire, he was blurting out with repeated frustration at the blank looks on the poor guy's face behind the counter. He was asking for the horloge. And the horloge is the clock on the wall. Got to get the words right. The principal word in the Old Testament for time, and the word that is repeated 29 times in 8 verses here, is the word eth. If you want to write it out in English, you could write A-Y-T-H, or if you pronounced it a little bit more correctly, just E-T-H would do. And it is a word that has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with clocks and calendars, with filofaxes. It has nothing to do with Microsoft Outlook or whatever your time management software happens to be. it has nothing whatsoever to do with what we usually mean when we say time. The word eth has nothing whatsoever to do with dates and what goes on a clock. So if we were to ask the question, what time is it, using the time that Koheleth has in mind, then we would not be expecting somebody to say 7, 12, and 24 seconds. The Jews, the Hebrew people to whom Koheleth was writing, and he was one of them, of course, had almost no concept of what we refer to as the passage of time being measured by hours, minutes, seconds, days, weeks, months. Their concept of time was not the measuring off of the flow of time, it was the content of the time. So their time has to do with the seasons. What is this the season for? So you look at the things that define the season for you. You look at the sky. You look at what's going on the ground. You feel the temperature of the wind and the direction of the wind. And you know what time it is. You know that it's time to plant. And you don't start planting because somebody has said, you know, it's half past Tuesday afternoon in the middle of October or whatever it happens to be. You don't start planting because it's that day in the calendar that says, start planting. You plant because of the season. You plant because everything around you tells you that it's time to plant. In fact, so useless at calendars were the Jews that half the words for their months are loan words. So they go off into exile and they turn around and say, have you got a spare month for October that we could borrow, please? They just didn't have the language for it, because it was of no interest to them. But ask them, what is it time to do? And they will tell you. And Koheleth will tell you beautifully. And so this word eth gets used for feasts and festivals and seasons. It gets used, for instance, in Exodus 24:14, where there's this reference to three festivals at a particular time. And it's not sort of three times because it's three points on a calendar that you're to go and worship God. It is three times when the thing that should fill that moment is worship and gathering and a festival. There are three times when you need to stop everything else you're doing because it's time to fill the moment with devotion to God. So the use of the word time all the way through this poem in 1 through 8, the repeated thing, the thing that he's just trying to drum in with an almost audible rhythm, is not what time is it, but what is God doing? What is it his time for? That is, what is God pouring into this moment? Which, of course, requires an enormously greater amount of sensitivity than we develop if we organize our lives and our existence around calendars and clocks. If we do something just because it says 4 o'clock on the clock. Now, of course, we all know that the clocks are important. And they are so because we live in a culture of clocks and calendars. We all know that if the parking meter or what we've put into the voucher is going to run out at 4 o'clock, it is actually important to go back to your car at least by 4:10. We all know that it's relatively important that the minister stops around 7:30. Otherwise, you know, we know what's going to happen. Carry on for all eternity. I'm not saying throw away your clocks, throw away your calendars, throw away your watches. But the life that is lived under the God who made the sun is a life lived under the one who is sovereign. It's a life lived under the one who puts his content into a day, who puts his plans into action,
who puts his changes in front of us when we would never have put them there ourselves. So the wise question, and Ecclesiastes is part of that wisdom literature, is to teach the wise way to live before God. Most of Ecclesiastes does it by showing the folly of living not before God. The wise way for the Christian to live, for the grown-up Christian to live, is not to ask, right, what must I do now because it is this time on the clock or the calendar? But it's to ask a question of God. To ask a question about the way the light is, the sun is, the air, the temperature, the moisture, the rain, what's the ground doing? To ask the farmer's question, what is God bringing together? What is God doing? And since he is sovereign, how must I respond? Do you remember what Jesus said about those who are born of the Spirit? He says to Nicodemus in John 3, Nicodemus, you can't see the wind. You see where it's going, but you can't see the wind. It's in the treetops, moves a breeze, you can't see it. It'll go here or there, you can't tell where it's going. And he says, so it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. Not because Christians are a right unpredictable bunch and like herding cats, but because Christians respond, because we are born of the Spirit of God, we respond to what God is doing. And God acts in some ways gloriously, thoughtlessly, with respect to our neat arrangement of the flow of time, our neat planning of the flow of time with our clocks and our calendars. So Koheleth wants these people to understand that the wise way to live is to read the Times. I don't mean read the Times rather than the Telegraph or the Press and Journal or whatever, but to read the Times. In fact, people are commended in Scripture as being wise because they can read the time, they can read the seasons, they can see what God is doing, they have a discernment of what God is bringing together and know how to act in that moment. So how do we, with God, take this winding and contradictory path through life? How do we, with God, acknowledging the fact that there's a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, time to uproot, and all these things, how do we accept this and follow this? Well, first of all, we do it without dismay and without fear. We do it without trying to insist that life has to be a smooth, sweeping, endless set of gracefully taken curves. We do it without this myth burrowing away in our heads, taunting us and oppressing us, in a sense, that if only we got our act together, life would be smooth. It isn't, because God doesn't do it that way. So we do it without dismay and fear, without beating ourselves up when life looks contradictory and life is unplannable. We do often think, don't we, that the best life is the life that we have planned. And yet, how many of us planned the most significant meetings of our lives? How many of us planned the most significant chance encounters? How many of us planned to be born where we were born? How many of us planned the parents that we've got? So we take the contradictions, we take the winding path as coming from God without dismay, without fear, without this sort of sense it must be a disaster because it's sweeping, going left, right, left, right. But we also do it with a request. And the request is, Lord, show me what you are doing here. Now, that's not usually our first guidance question, is it? Our first guidance question is usually, and this is perhaps the only one we ever ask, is, Lord, show me what I've got to do here.
If that's your starting point, then Koheleth was writing to you. If our starting point in the guidance thing and living the wise life is, Lord, show me what to do, then this wonderful poem was written to us. The first question of the disciple of Jesus Christ, who is born by the Spirit and lives before the Father, the first question, in fact, until it's answered, the only question that counts is, Lord, show me what you're doing here. Help me to understand what you are about in this moment. Now. Give me sensitivity now to what you are doing now. Waken me to this moment. Not a mythical tomorrow. Not a remembered past. But make me alive and alert to what you are doing now in this moment. Jesus had it. Remember when he said to the disciples, we've spent all night fishing and caught nothing, toiling away, experienced fishermen. Fishing by night was commonplace to them. They knew exactly what they were doing. They knew the Sea of Galilee like the back of their hands. Experienced fishermen had caught nothing all night. Looked very, very silly, I'm sure. And Jesus stands on the shore and says, throw your net out over the other side. And at that moment, a shoal of fish just happened to be passing. I mean, what do you think? The fish was sort of sitting there all night, hiding, and then suddenly, you know, oh no, our time's come. So either it was like this, or it didn't happen. At that moment, throw your nets out on the other side. Do it now. Now is the time. Now is the moment. You must do it now. Because the great creator of the universe had got a great big shoal of fish passing by the boat on the other side. See, Jesus knew the time. So he could say, my time has not yet come. And he wouldn't do something, even though the thing would be a good thing to do. So the first question of the disciple, first question of the person who has learned the wisdom that the Bible teaches us, first question of the grown-up Christian is not, what must I do here? It is, Lord, show me what you are doing here. Do not let me miss your content that you are pouring into this moment. Do not let me miss what you are bringing together, a need, a person, a decision, a change in the weather, a change in the tide, a change in the curve of the hill. Do not let me miss your content for this moment. And then the second response of the Christian, the grown-up Christian, is to say, Lord, help me respond to what you are doing, not to what I would want. Help me respond to what you are doing. After God has helped us to discern what he is doing in the moment, then it's, Lord, help me to respond. The time has come for this, so I will not worry about not doing that. I must worry about missing this. Well, not worry. But my concern must not be for all the 101 things that this moment isn't about. My concern as a disciple of Christ must be not to miss the one thing that this moment is about. My concern as a human being living before God cannot be, if I'm learning Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8, it cannot be, oh Lord, I wish this was a time for dancing, when in actual fact, it is a time to mourn. That's why, you see, we can do what Jesus talked about when he said, weep with those who weep and rejoice, party with those who party. What is God pouring into the moment of the people that you're with? How are you going to respond to them? Respond to what God is doing in the moment. And if it's a moment of grief, weep with them. If it's a moment of celebration, get dancing, if you can dance. Take what God sends. It was A.W. Pink once said, "It's too wise to err and too loving to be unkind." So what is God doing in your life just now? What is he bringing together? You're in the boat is that distance from the shore. What shoal of fish is God bringing past you? What are the needs? What are the people? What are the opportunities? What are the doors that are opening, the ones that are closing? What are the truly vital things that have to be addressed? What is it that God is pouring into this moment? A grown-up Christian asks, "Lord, what are you doing?" And then, once a grown-up Christian has discerned what God is doing, and you'll never do something that is sinful, never do something that's wrong, but you discern what God is doing, then the grown-up Christian asks, "Lord, help me to move with it now." Dennis Lennon, who was the rector of St. Thomas's Kostorphan in Edinburgh, and then Dennis became the diocesan advisor to the Bishop of Sheffield. Dennis Lennon was talking about this thing, which in New Testament terms, this word for time is kairos, this kairos thing, this sensing the moment and responding to what God is doing, this art of discipleship. He was talking about and illustrated it with something that happened in his own life, which stuck with me, so I'll share it with you. Dennis and his wife had been missionaries amongst the Kalimantan people in Southeast Asia. They had been with OMF there, and they had come back to England. Dennis was a minister, assistant minister in Cambridge, and he was wondering why on earth they were there. They had sensed it was the right thing to be there, but they just didn't know why they were there. And he told the story of walking on the pavement just by the church. He'd been standing at the outside of the church building looking at some feature of it. Turned around, and round the corner came a group of Kalimantan people in their national costume. And it was one of those, you know, am I hallucinating moments? But, well, he was a vicar, so he might have been. They were not expecting to meet somebody on the street standing outside a church in Cambridge who could speak their language. And so he got chatting to them. "Oh, well, I work here. It's a church. Christians." Straight in. It was that moment. What is God pouring into the moment for you and for me? What is God pouring into the moment for us at Gilcomston? What are the shifts in the tide? What are the shifts in the weather? How must we do the thing that we are called to in this moment? Not what would we like the moment to be. Not what would we like a future moment to be. Not what was the past moment like. But what is God pouring into this moment now? And the ability to answer that question and to act accordingly is the art that a grown-up Christian needs to develop in following Jesus. Let's pray.